Hey everybody, this is Patrick at the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're here with another of our virtual events. And tonight we have a special treat. Our good friend, John Talton, is back via Zoom from Seattle. We're going to be talking about this wonderful new book, The City of Dark Corners, which is the book that John's been hinting at and wanting to write, I think, for an awfully long time. And then I also have, just for fun, brought a copy of the first book here, Concrete Desert. And let's see, everybody watching on Facebook, if you have questions for John, go ahead and put them in the comments field. I'll do my best to keep an eye on that. But Barbara's at her home office, and she's gonna be doing the heavy lifting. But I'll be lurking in the background.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Patrick, very much. I'm gonna hold up my mug from La Posada Hotel in Winslow, Arizona. Santa Fe Railroad design on it, John, that I brought here because I thought it would be appropriate for talking about your book.
That is excellent.
It is indeed. So John Talton is a business and finance columnist and authority. He's written forever. He's also had a couple of interesting jobs before he became a journalist, including, do I have it right? You were a medic or an ambulance driver, something in the medical field.
I was an REMT-3 paramedic, and we took umbrage at being called ambulance drivers, but I did that for 5 years. And then I taught theater at a small college in Southeast Oklahoma, and I was able to get more money as a reporter at the small town newspaper. And so my misbegotten career was launched.
Well, you know, those activities fostered some of your books, the two Cincinnati casebook files, casebook mysteries that you wrote, certainly draw upon your experience as a medic and your wonderful standalone Deadline Man. John and I actually call each other Deadline Man and Deadline Woman because we had such a good time with that book. Was in the newspaper industry in Seattle. And John has long documented in his own way in fiction the decline of the newspaper industry. So we're grateful that he had that experience so he could write that wonderful book. He's written 9 David Mapstone books, which were set here in Phoenix. The most recent was Bomb Shelter. And tonight, he's also written a nonfiction book, which I think had a lot to do with this particular novel, A Brief History of Phoenix. But in The Bomb Shelter, John also used the same material to explore much of Phoenix's seamy, shady past. And what I really love is that he takes on a lot of real life characters like Barry Goldwater and his brother and other gang members, not other, and gang members and other things, or rather not gang members, but actual criminal, you know. Right, some of the mob. And, you know, Phoenix has an interesting past that you can't guess at so easily today when it's all full of, retirees and income. But it's not true anymore anyway, John, because Phoenix has really become much more economically diversified over the last, 10 years?
I would say not so much. If you looked at Phoenix in 1980, it had a much more diverse economy than it does today. And I mean, I don't care what the boosters say, that when they talk about, we've got a lot of tech, you're at the low end of technology with data centers. They don't create many jobs, and they're certainly not high-end jobs. Behind me is the Amazon headquarters with 50,000 high-paid jobs. That's a technology center. Phoenix is not, sad to say. But it's dependent on population growth until the Ponzi scheme wears out. And I'm a fourth generation Arizonan. It breaks my heart.
Oh, I don't know. You know, the biomedical field here is really blossoming. I mean, the Mayo Clinic campus is extraordinary and growing at a rate that is hard to imagine. It was just desert out there. And now it's ranging all the way from Scottsdale Road to Tatum.
Yeah, and again, it's all sprawl building. Why not leave the desert alone out there and build it in downtown Phoenix. But then B, you have to benchmark it against what? So what are your leading biomedical centers? Well, you've got one here in Seattle, which is about four blocks from me. It begins in the Innovation Center in South Lake Union. You've got San Diego anchored by Scripps. You've got it at the Texas Medical Center in Houston, where you have multiple medical schools, multiple hospitals, all in a few blocks, all clustered together. And so Phoenix loves to measure itself against itself, but it only really matters when you're measuring it against the top and against the peers. And against the peers, it still comes off as punching below its weight. That's not hating Arizona, that's just reality.
Well, I'm certainly not in a position to argue with you, but to me, it feels like there's a lot of development going on.
There's development.
I don't mean building
for an hour.
No. Well, let's not go there. I mean, there's a hotel on every corner now, so that part's not good. But I just feel like there's more diversification than you might feel that is right for a big city. But
I write about this every week on Rogue Columnist, where I continue to write about Phoenix issues. And I write about it because nobody else does.
Well, I can't argue with that. But let's hark back to the time period of City of Dark Corners, because when you wrote A Brief History of Phoenix, you had to do a really deep dive. How far back? Was it the 1930s, the 1920s?
Well, I mean, I know a lot of Phoenix history simply because my great-grandparents came there in the 19th century. And so I've been deep diving my whole life. I could have written a book that was 400 pages long, but this History Press Arcadia scam, did I say that? I take that back. They want a lot of pictures and they don't want a lot of text, and I crammed in a lot more text than they wanted, but they just had to suck it up and go with it. I wanted to write about the things that made Phoenix extraordinary and special through its entire history, from the end of the Civil War, when Phoenix was first had people start to come there and take a look at it, like Jack Swilling, all the way to the real estate collapse in around 2010.
Okay. So in the process, you picked on some key figures. I always go to, when we go downtown, I'm trying to remember, I'm having a senior moment. What's the restaurant that I'm always thinking of where the mob hangs? It's down on Central.
Yeah, it's in Midtown, actually, and it's called Durant's.
Thank you.
And it's still there, and they make fabulous martinis.
It is still there, and, it's still decorated. Like, it reminds me of the old Russian tea room in New York, but,
Exactly.
I hope they never change it, because it's a period piece, but I always think about it as kind of a gathering place for a lot of colorful figures, if not criminal figures anyway, that made up Phoenix's past.
Yes, governors and legislators go there regularly. And so you're right about that. But seriously, I mean, Durant's is a see and be seen place by everybody, especially Phoenix's powerful. But back in the day, Jack Durant, who founded it in, say, the 50s and 60s and into the early 70s, he bragged about his connections to the mob. And it was one of many hangouts that the mob had, like the Blue Grotto and the Ivanhoe. The Ivanhoe was where John Harvey Adamson hatched the plan to set a bomb under Don Bowles' car, the Arizona Republic reporter, in 1976, when I was working on the ambulance that day. And all of that is gone. I mean, Durant's is now just a wonderful place that if you come to Phoenix and don't go there, you're missing a lot. And Carol McElroy, the owner, is a wonderful person.
And the Ivanhoe is gone. I can well remember it because I first came to Phoenix from Chicago in 1950 as a winter visitor because my grandfather was a paraplegic and he couldn't do Chicago. So he lived at the old Mountain Shadows for much of the year. That was back when you flew into Terminal One and there was one little baggage carousel. It was outdoors, sort of like the airport in Kona, Hawaii. And the city limit, I think, was trying to remember if it actually went farther east than the Biltmore, but you had to take a buckboard really to get to the Camelback Inn or certainly to get out to Frank Lloyd Wright. I think there were only two paved roads in Scottsdale, which wasn't even incorporated at that point. So it was definitely old Phoenix.
But, well, and you could have taken the train.
Yes, there was still what Union Station downtown was still going.
Oh, it was thriving, and we had daily Chicago train service with the Golden State Limited as the most direct and fastest and elite train, but multiple trains a day.
Well, and if President Biden gets his way and manages to put money into the infrastructure and the railroads, it's possible that Amtrak will now come to Phoenix.
Well, it will take state involvement. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason that Phoenix lost Amtrak was Fife Symington, Governor Sheff, would not step forward and pay for the track upgrades. I mean, we've got a thriving Amtrak in Seattle, and they do in Southern California simply because the state is involved.
Well, we'll have to see how it goes. I don't even want to get into discussion of current Arizona politics because every day the Clown Car Act here with the ballots and so forth lands us on the front page of either the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or something. So God only knows.
Real consequences.
What seems so silly is that, you know, with the light rail, Union Station is perfectly situated to be, a hub for not just the light rail, but Amtrak. I mean, it seems like such a no-brainer. And I'm hearing rumblings. Have you heard these, John, that it's being considered?
I don't hear that. What, Denver did a wonderful job of restoring its Union Station. It has a hotel inside. Yep. And Denver's extensive light rail and commuter heavy rail and Amtrak all go there. And it is just magnificent what they've done. I suggested that they, and continued to suggest on Rogue Columnist, that they take the South Phoenix extension over to Third Avenue and take it down Third Avenue and then bring it back to Central. And that way it would go right past.
I know, it's right there.
It would go right past Union Station. Yeah. And they didn't do it. And so we never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
It's funny, the other night, I was driving downtown. And I swear, even in the last year during the, during this pandemic, my wife and I were driving, We took a left from Jefferson onto Second Street, and we're going up. And I'm thinking, this is right where Paris Alley was,
Well, one half block to the south was Paris Alley.
Yeah, right in this area. And then what's interesting, and I wanted to bring this up too, is there are some people online, and I see you commenting or liking, apparently there's a great group of young I'm assuming amateur historians who have really been digging up some interesting photos and things. Pictures of the Deuce have been so scarce, and you're starting to see a little more and more, and that's really great to see.
If you go to my Rogue Columnist site, I have a column that is entitled The Deuce, and it has many photos.
Yeah, yeah. I know for a while, perhaps when you were doing some research, you were looking for photographs of the old the old warehouses along the tracks, and they were hard to find.
Well, I found them. A wonderful resource is the McCullough Brothers Archive at ASU.
Yeah.
But I've got them now, and I put them out there for free on Rogue Columnist.
That's fantastic.
It helps if you give image credit to McCullough Brothers ASU Archives or the Library of Congress.
And there's the McLaughlin collection too, right? We have a big book on early Phoenix that has a lot of those great photographs.
Yeah, I wish I had the money to get access to the McLaughlin collection.
Right.
Well, let's drop back to the Depression, because we want to talk about City of Dark Corners and Gene Hammond. And Gene Hammond is a World War I veteran, right? And he's now in Phoenix. Why did you decide to write? Well, obviously you couldn't take David Mapstone back there, so you were going to have to create a new character if you wanted to write an historical novel about Phoenix. So, did you design Gene Hammond? What did you decide what kind of person should he be, and what should his background be?
I started writing this book at a time when Donald Trump was president, and the far left was as crazy as the far right. And the idea of writing something in contemporary America was so mortifying that I thought it would be better to go back to the Depression, because we know everything turned out okay, thanks to Franklin Roosevelt, who, by the way, carried Arizona in a landslide, and the New Deal was extremely good to Arizona. And so I wanted to set it in 1933 Phoenix, and Gene, like Peralta and Mapstone and Lindsay, just kind of started walking around in my head one day. And I wanted him to have been a Phoenix detective who had been pushed out of the department. And then he makes his living as a private eye looking for people who disappeared in the Depression. And there are plenty of them. And he has a brother named Don, who is the rake of the family. And they're both native Phoenicians. And they both went off and fought in, at that point, was called the Great War, because there wasn't a World War II yet. And Don is still a detective on the force, and so we're off to the races.
It's always good when you have a private detective or somebody not in law enforcement to have a connection to law enforcement, because at some point, somebody needs to have a power of arrest, which is the title of one of your books, actually.
Which I actually got that from you, because we were brainstorming about what is the future of Will Borders in the Cincinnati case books after the pain nurse. And I said, well, maybe he could become a private eye. And you said, well, but he won't have powers of arrest. And so I kept him on the force, and I took the title.
Yes, you did. And I love those two books. I always wish that you had written more of them, but
I wish Cincinnati sold.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's important to remember, we had this discussion with Jeffrey Deaver on Monday night, that, it is a business. Publishing is a business, and writing, unless you're independently wealthy, is, requires compensation. And so sometimes people write wonderful books, but if they don't sell, it doesn't make a lot of financial sense for them to continue. But I thought those two books were absolutely fabulous. I love Powers.
Well, thank you.
Well, I did. I mean, we worked really hard on them together. I think one of the best opening scenes you ever wrote was in Powers of Arrest.
I know. And I know you like that. And Cincinnati is such an evocative, wonderful city. I don't understand why novels set there don't do better.
You know, it's true. There are some places that are real hot spots and other places that just get no attention. I mean, if you think about the sheer density of people in fiction who are running around doing stuff in Boston or Seattle or Minneapolis, and yet strangely fewer in Chicago. I mean, yeah. That doesn't make a lot of sense. Charleston has maybe, you know, like two. In Phoenix, you know, we have you and Isabella Maldonado, who's relatively new at it. And who else do we have? Betty wrote about Scottsdale. But Patrick, can you remember other people who've actually set mysteries?
My friend, James Stain,
okay,
has written a really good, really good police procedural series. And in fact, his new one is the title comes as an homage to John in a way. It's called South of the Deuce. and that came from when, I don't remember, know if you recall, but years ago, we had that downtown location for a minute down there on Grant. And you did an event, John, and there was some discussion of where exactly the Deuce was in relation to where we were. And you said, no, this is south of the Deuce. And that stuck with Jim. And he wrote a really fine police procedural set in Phoenix that kind of harkens back to old history in a way that you do.
Work your own side of the street, buddy.
So that's
work your own side of the Deuce.
Right. Well, that's only three compared to like 29 authors writing about Boston or something. But I don't know, John. I mean, I have no idea why Cincinnati or Cleveland, you know, neither is exactly evocative. Les Roberts wrote the longest series of books set in Cleveland. And then our own Poison Pen Press author, Annie Hoxett, wrote three, I think it is, maybe four, set in Cleveland. But for some reason, Ohio just doesn't seem to, you know, fire up the... What do you know about Louisville or Lexington or, you know, Knoxville? No. I mean, there's...
If you set a book in Miami or Los Angeles or New York, you're set. I don't get it. So Phoenix has been my muse. And the first book, Concrete Desert, was kind of a love letter home when I was working in Cincinnati and never thought I would come home. And then it has stayed that way. And it's that way with the latest book, even though it's set in the Depression.
Well, it starts out with a really interesting scene. And since we were talking about railroads, so why don't you tell us about how this book opens? Because certainly the railroad geography is a part of it.
Well, originally it was titled Sunset Limited, which was the elite passenger train of the Southern Pacific Railroad that went through Phoenix, east and west.
Still is called that, isn't it?
Well, it is on Amtrak, but it doesn't go through Phoenix.
Doesn't go through Phoenix, right.
Not the elite train that it once was. But so originally it even had a railroad name. But it starts out where Gene is on the job, and he parks his car by a Hooverville, and he walks into it and gets first into an altercation because somebody like him is not going to be welcome there. And then he finally finds this man whose family has come into some money in Chicago, and he persuades him to come with him to Union Station, which at that point is less than 10 years old. It opened in 1923, sends him home. And later he gets a telegram that he actually arrived there, because he tips the porter to try to keep an eye on him on the train, but there's no guarantee that he won't just get off and drink himself to death.
But what does Jane find when he's down around this area? Because he runs across a dismembered body, right?
Well, not at first.
No.
At first, he's coming back to his car, and a young man named Kemper Marley, who has way more money than good sense, pulls in with a bunch of thugs in the back of his truck with bats and gasoline to go burn the Hooverville down and drive the people out. It's later that the heart of the mystery begins, where Don Hammonds, who's still a detective, comes to Gene to enlist him in a murder where a young woman has been dismembered, but in a very beautiful, elegant suit, and in her purse is Gene's business card, even though Gene has no idea who she is. And so that's the heart of things without giving away too much.
Yeah, well, tell us about Hooverville, because there are a lot of people listening to this who may not have any idea what a Hooverville was.
Well, considering there are something like 25,000 history majors in the entire United States now, I'm not surprised, and although I'm horrified, Herbert Hoover, who was a man of tremendous accomplishments, was elected president in 1928. And unfortunately, he was not prepared to deal with the Great Depression, which began in late 1929. And so he was blamed for it. And the vagrant camps full of Okies and Arkies and farmers who had lost their places to foreclosure, who were going west to the promised land of California, as in the Grapes of Wrath and the Joad family, or sometimes just outside any big city, they would have these shacks and shanties, and they named them after the president and called them Hoovervilles.
How do they differ from homeless encampments today, people living under, you know, freeways and so forth?
The difference is completely, we could spend the entire time on it. I mean, back then there was a common code of conduct that you didn't just lie on the sidewalk and do your drugs. People who had mental issues were institutionalized. There were single room occupancy hotels that were very cheap that hobos and bums lived in. These were people who had lost everything and had nothing. And as soon as they could get out of that, they did so. And what we now call quote unquote homelessness is an entirely different phenomenon.
And endless. I mean, you know.
Well, it's endless as long, it's endless as long as you continue policies that subsidize it, that don't insist that people get treatment, don't insist that they, you don't get freebies, and you don't get to be somebody just lying on the sidewalk pitching your tent. We used to have vagrancy laws. Look, these are all God's children. They are all individually precious in his sight. But the policies we're doing now, especially in a place like Seattle, are not helping them. They're making it worse.
Well, I do find the contrast in Seattle between, you know, the tech industry and all of that, and then the incredible homeless problem. Well, it's also true in San Francisco.
They call this Free-attle, because there are so many giveaways to people who don't want to live a conventional lifestyle. Now, if you've been evicted and you lost your job and you have a couple of children, we have the means to help that person. If you're like most of the quote unquote homeless population here, you'll walk right out the door. They don't just need a home. They need a very complex spectrum of responses. And as I say, we could talk about that all night instead of talking about the book.
Well, Phoenix's climate is so severe that it does keep our homeless population down, because you can't really survive on the streets, you know, in the summer here as it's getting hotter. But in any case, in the Depression, there were Hoovervilles, as you say, and people, were more people coming to Phoenix passing through on their way to, quote, the promised land of California, rather than having Phoenix as a destination?
They would come to Phoenix if there was farm work to be done, because in those days, Phoenix was the center of an agricultural empire. It was called American Eden. And so in those days, if there was picking of citrus or lettuce or melons or whatever, you could grow anything in the Salt River Valley. Then they would stay for those weeks or months and then move on to the next site. But other than that, they were going through.
So what happens when this dismembered body is found? What did the police think about it? And what does that propel Gene into doing?
Well, again, without giving away too much of the plot, the police are happy to close this case, saying that she fell off a train. The Sunset Limited had come through. And Jean is not sure that that's true for several reasons. One is that she's dressed so well, dismembered, so she obviously was dismembered and then redressed. And her wounds are not consistent with those of the flanges of a train wheel. And then her purse is set at a distance, and inside her purse is his business card. And all of these things make Jean think that no, she didn't fall off the train. And so he, on his own, begins to work the case. Even though he doesn't have a client, he's working the case partly because he's afraid that somebody's trying to frame him.
Uh-huh. Well, so
John, your story that you wrote for Phoenix Noir, that story about the railroad bull, was that taken from a kind of an early draft of this novel or an early incarnation of this book?
Not so much, but I have to give you credit. First of all, that book is a great, great read, and Patrick is the editor, and so I urge you to buy it and read it. I always wanted to write about trains and detectives, and Barbara said, nobody reads train detective books. And so that went nowhere. And finally, I was able to work trains and detectives into this book. And the guy in Bull, the short story in Phoenix Noir, is Jimmy Darrow, who makes an appearance in City of Dark Corners.
Right, and you've got all this wonderful cast of characters out of our history, you know, like Frenchie Navarre and, you know, Goldwater, and as you said, Kemper Marley and Rosenzweig. Can you talk, I mean, you know, I've been reading your stuff, your nonfiction as well as your fiction, for a long time. And one of the things that you've been saying from the very beginning is, hey people, there's a city here that nobody really, a lot of people don't know existed. You know, this, and you write about it, and you really give us a sense of what that city was like. Can you talk about how Phoenix did during the Depression compared to other cities? And when you talk about downtown Phoenix, discuss the area you're talking about. It's a much, much smaller, much more compact footprint in the 30s. And then when did it really grow out?
Well, let me
There's a lot of questions in there. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Let me beat my hobby horse here for a minute. Downtown, historically, is from the railroad tracks south to Fillmore north and 7th Avenue and 7th Street. And that's downtown. And that's downtown now.
Is that the original town site?
No, the original town site was the railroad tracks to Van Buren.
Okay.
So it was to Fillmore. Now, if you're very liberal in your geography, you can say it goes to Roosevelt. But downtown isn't just some place that you're scared to go. You know, downtown is not 24th Street and Camelback, which I've heard it called. Downtown is not Roosevelt Road. Roosevelt Road is near downtown. Downtown is not...
Uptown Plaza.
Yeah, but I mean, downtown is not the skyscrapers between Thomas and Indian School. That's Midtown.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much the same in the 1930s. Downtown, though, was the only center of commerce and the only place that Phoenix had its little mini skyscrapers from the 1920s, like the Lures building, the Lures Tower, the wonderful city county building that would become David Mapstone's office later. And
that professional building.
The professional building is done. The Phoenix Trust building is done, which is Orpheum Lofts. And so you, by 1930, you got a pretty nice little city there. And with, I don't know, 60,000 people. But Phoenix was very badly hurt by the Depression at first, because farm products prices fall and a lot of farmers are ruined. And the beginnings of a tourism industry are killed off and the railroads are badly hurt. And but the New Deal completely turns things around. Now, this book starts out in January 1933. Back then, we inaugurated presidents in March. And so Franklin Roosevelt hasn't been inaugurated yet. But Phoenix and Arizona received far more New Deal funding and New Deal projects than they deserved in terms of the population size or anything else, because we had people like Carl Hayden as senator. Today our Republican delegation wouldn't ask for anything for Arizona or for Phoenix. The only reason that we have the light rail is because of Ed Pastore, Democratic congressman. John McCain did nothing for Arizona. John Kyle did nothing for Arizona in terms of this. And so if you look at a whole bunch of stuff like the Central Avenue underpass under the railroad tracks and the 17th Avenue underpass under the railroad tracks, trails in along South Mountain Park and up Piestewa Peak. All of these things are projects that were undertaken by various agencies of the New Deal.
Indian School Park, Encanto Park, portions of that.
Well, Encanto Park, I mean, the steel Indian School Park didn't exist because it was, wait for it. It was the Indian School,
right?
And it was used as the Indian School.
And
that
was
far outside the city.
There's a lot of WPA, street stamps all over, downtown. And it's interesting how, and you know this, of course, how you can date the city's spread by the concrete stamps. And also,
right.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the ones you want to look for north of downtown in the historic districts like Roosevelt or F.Q. Story or Willow, where I grew up, and these are not downtown, these are north of downtown, is Frenchie View. And yes. Frenchie View was the sidewalk magnet, and you know, you can actually go out and do a charcoal stamp on a piece of paper of a Frenchie View sidewalk thing, because they're, as they get old, they're replaced by the city with something boring. If you go down
Third Avenue.
Oh, I think it's Fifth Avenue. If you go down Fifth Avenue at Portland, on the north west corner is this Italianate mansion with a sweeping veranda. And that was Frenchie View's house, not to be confused with Frenchie Navarro, the cop.
Is that the one that looks right out on Kenilworth School?
No.
Right across from the dog park now?
No. This is Portland.
Oh, Portland, so, excuse me, a little bit
from, you know, it's like one block north of Roosevelt.
Yeah, because I live in FQ Story, and we walk all up and down this area, you know, and you know, are paying attention to all the sidewalk stamps.
Yeah,
and that's fun. Yeah,
it's like Roman SPQR.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, Frenchie View was our SPQR.
Absolutely. So without giving away anything of the plot, one of the other enjoyable things about City of Dark Corners is that we make a foray up to Prescott.
We do.
And there's a lot of interesting history in Prescott, which people forget was the original state capital.
It was the original territorial capital.
Oh, sorry. Okay, you're right. It moved to Phoenix when the territory became the state, right?
Well, it moved to Phoenix in the late 1880s, early 1890s. And Phoenix, Arizona became a state in 1912. Prescott was the center of a mining district, and became very rich off those mines for a while. And of course, Jerome was nearby. And Prescott was also an important subdivision point on the Santa Fe Railroad between Ash Fork and Williams and Phoenix. And so there's still in Prescott this beautiful building that was the railroad station, because Prescott built itself around the railroad. It had a railroad yard, and they had to change engines there. The trains would come up over Iron Springs, which was this very tough grade. And around 1960, the Paulden Cutoff made Prescott just a branch line. And so the railroad died there, which is a heartbreaker. But what people don't know, especially if they just live in the sprawl of Prescott and the abortion that is Prescott Valley, no disrespect, then that Prescott has so much history preserved in the Charlotte Hall Museum, and has some wonderful Victorian houses. And before part of it burned down, Whiskey Row had this great history behind it. One time there was a fire on Whiskey Row, and as they were putting it out, they set up sawhorses and lumber on top of it, and they were serving drinks.
Why not? I've stayed at the Hacienda Inn more than once. And, you know, the courthouse is always a wonderful place in the holidays because they do great decorations. So, you know, just that central little part of Prescott still feels like an old Arizona, but
a real town.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Winslow because I am so fond of the Santa Fe Railroad Hotel that has been restored there. Yeah. Called
Alan Alpen.
Yeah, and of course now he's over in New Mexico doing, you know, the same thing in Las Vegas, New Mexico, not to be confused with Las Vegas, Nevada, which is interestingly enough the headquarters of Scientology and also the home of the Arnold Hammer University. I'm trying to remember what's the
Arm and Hammer.
Yeah, isn't it the university there in Las Vegas, New Mexico?
Well, that's UNLV, and are you sure that Scientology is not based in Los Angeles?
No, I think there's a whole thing of it in Las Vegas. I've been to see it.
Oh, I mean, they're everywhere. They're in downtown Seattle.
Well, there is a, okay, maybe it is Los Angeles, but there is a thing there. But I could swear it was Arnold Hammer University has a campus there. And anyway, the same guy that has developed La Posada, the Santa Fe River Hotel, has done two hotels in Las Vegas. And it's interesting, you know, because the in Santa Fe, the La Fonda is the Santa Fe Railroad Hotel in Santa Fe. And then there was one in Albuquerque. And, you know, I love the whole history of, you know, the Harvey, Fred Harvey and the Harvey girls and the railroad and the whole bit.
I love how the main entrance is trackside, not streetside.
That's absolutely
true. Yeah, absolutely.
It used to be.
And these are the works of Mary Ann or Mary Jane Coulter.
Mary Jane, the
architect. She did those, and she also did El Tovar at the south rim of the Grand Canyon, which is right down the steps from the Santa Fe Railroad Depot.
True enough. The south rim
was developed by the railroad.
Yeah, there's a permanent Harvey Girls display in Santa Fe in the museum on the plaza, and they have wonderful pictures. But of course, one of the things they have are these big touring cars, and you know, the young women, and so passengers could disembark and get into the touring cars and be driven up to the Grand Canyon or whatever. You know, Fred Harvey was really a visionary. I mean, to an extraordinary extent, and created. I mean, the West wouldn't be the same without Fred Harvey and the railroad.
Well, and the funny thing is that in what is today Willow on Cypress Street, I lived right across the street from Byron Harvey III and his children and wife Joy Harvey. And they are descendants of Fred Harvey. And went to Kenilworth School with them. They eventually moved over to Palmcroft. And so I knew the Harveys growing up, and I'm still in touch with at least one of them.
Weren't you on Holly for a long time, John?
After I came back to Phoenix, I was on Holly. And it killed me to have to give that house up when they kicked me out of the Republic for calling the real estate crash.
Had they closed off the alleys or the end of the street at that point, or were they still open?
They closed it off, and I hate that because we don't want it to be a gated property.
Right.
The appealing thing about these straight, honest streets is that they're not a gated property in Scottsdale. No offense to Scottsdale, of course, where I went to high school.
None taken. Right. One of the points I was trying to make is that while it's called City of Dark Corners and the focus is Phoenix, that you actually get to tour more of Arizona than Phoenix to go up to Prescott. And, you know, last night we did an event called with an historical novel by CNN's Jake Tapper. And, you know, everybody's raving on about, you know, the wonderful history in it. And I pointed out to Mr. Tamper, it's set in 1962. It was the year I graduated from Stanford. So he's 52 and I'm 80. So for him, it was an historical novel and he's looking back on it. For me, I lived through it. And it was really interesting to see him ripping off masks, because without social media and other things, much of the shenanigans that a lot of his characters, the Rat Pack and so forth, got up to, or Rock Hudson, who was gay at a time when Hollywood didn't want him to appear gay and so forth, wasn't known. I mean, I was so surprised reading it to recognize how little I knew about the reality of these people, you know, a celebrity group, because it was very carefully camouflaged from us at the time we lived through it. And he also talked about the magnetism in his first book, The Hellfire Club of Joseph McCarthy. And people today think, seriously, there was any magnetism to McCarthy? But now that we've been through Trump, I think we should recognize that people like that actually do have. And I remember all of that. I mean, I remember the whole rise and fall of McCarthy. So it's unnerving to have your life become history, but I'm safe in the 1930s because even I wasn't alive then. And
well, yeah, I am too. I wish I had his bank book, but why isn't it James Ellroy who has an entire series that is set in the 50s and early 60s involving the mob and brings in Kennedy's assassination and I forget the titles. You would know better than me.
Or yeah, American Tabloid. And
yes, exactly.
Yeah, and he obsessively goes over this stuff. And, you know, and it's fascinating. We were talking a little bit about him last night. But I was just getting back to the 1930s and Phoenix. And can you talk a little bit about Gus Greenbaum? I was... A number of years ago, I'm sure you remember the piece. There was this wonderful series in the New Times about, you know, the secrets of the Lurs building and secrets of the Lurs Tower. And they interviewed this guy at that time, I believe this was in the 1990s. And this older gentleman who, you know, had all these, you know, first person accounts of everything that was going on in the 20s. You know, he worked in the building. And it was just a great series. And, you know, so we learn a little bit about Gus Greenbaum at the very top of the, was it the Lurs Tower or the Lurs building itself?
Lurs Tower.
That's what I thought. Yeah. And thank God that building is still there. You know?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it does such a horrible job of tearing down, you know, its history.
One of the things that's interesting to me is that you see these people when they are young or relatively young. So, for instance, Barry Goldwater is in the book, and he's in his late 20s, maybe about to turn 30. Gene Hammons is only about 33 years old. But Gus Greenbaum has been sent to Phoenix by the Chicago outfit to set up a gambling wire for the Southwest. And the gambling wire is able to fix horse races by transmitting on its own telegraph system information such as a jockey has been changed or the winner is suddenly called and before Western Union and the Associated Press or the United Press can officially announce it, the mob's gambling wire telegraphs this, and there are gamblers who are willing to pay for that extra edge. And they'll be taking bets right up to the end. If they're betting on a horse that's already lost. And so it's rather elaborate, and Gus Greenbaum was there to oversee it. Kimber Marley, who wants to be the King of Phoenix, wants the Chicago outfit to give him the gambling business. He's already going to get the liquor business when we come out of Prohibition at the end of the year. And so it makes for a interesting rogues gallery.
And you have Del Webb also figures into this book.
Del Webb is there. And Harry Rosenzweig, who built the Arizona Republican Party, persuaded Barry Goldwater to run first for city council and then for Senate. There's a bunch of them. And I, at the end of the book, instead of my usual acknowledgments, thanks, Barbara, I take each of the book characters who are real and say what went on to happen to them, because who knows when it'll be my last book. I don't have Jake Tapper's bank book.
Is it true, and just to kind of digress for a second, but is it true that Del Webb designed some of the internment camps?
It is absolutely true. He designed, I believe, Poston.
He might have
constructed more than that. Designed gives it rather a dignity that it doesn't deserve. You know, who was the architect of Auschwitz? And of course, that's apples and oranges, but these were internment camps. And yes, Del Webb, Del Webb was really made by the Great Depression because so much construction money came in that Del Webb was already there with the construction company. He ended up becoming one of the richest men in the Southwest. He was a part owner of the New York Yankees, and all of this was before he ruined us with retirees by building Sun City. Phoenix used not to be a place that retirees came.
Can you talk a little bit?
When did that change, John? When did he put up Sun City? I can't even remember.
It was around 1960.
Okay.
Right. That was kind of when John Long and isn't that about the same time all those communities, Avondale and the sort of master planned communities were built?
Well, I mean, a master planned community is like the Holy Roman Empire. It's neither master plan nor a community. It's just a bunch of subdivisions. Maryvale was built by John F. Long and named after his wife, Mary Tomalchuk. It was built on the agricultural fields, the beet fields west of the city, and it became a part of the city. John F. Long also served on the city council. It was not one of these things out in the middle of nowhere, and they built starter homes and they were wildly popular. It was not a place where Black folks could get a loan. It was Phoenix's first Levitt town, although John F. Long did many innovations that were widely copied in the building industry. So I wouldn't compare Maryvale with these horrible sprawl master plan communities that Phoenix has now. But yes, it was about the same time. John Long, I think, started Maryvale in the late 1950s. I know that my uncle bought a house from John F. Long in Maryvale, and it was so new and so beautiful, and it had an all-electric kitchen, and it had a swimming pool. And we were there at 314 West Cypress in this 1924 Spanish colonial revival house that just was old, and it had a gas-fired stove. And of course, that house is worth $1 million now, and the house in Maryvale is probably worth $150,000.
Just as a more general thing, at the beginning of the book, you make kind of a disclaimer about, hey, dear reader, be prepared. This is going to use language that may offend you that's correct to the period. And I think it's so important. And that's one thing I do like about James Ellroy, is that he doesn't sanitize history for our protection. I think when you're writing about Phoenix during the 30s or any place, you have to remain true to the attitudes and the language of the period. And I'm glad that you do that.
Well, thank you. I was reluctant to put in that trigger warning. I don't want to think that my readers are stupid people, but I put it in. And if it gives me any brownie points with the woke, then good for them.
Well, I mean, there's the tendency to kind of, tame the language a bit. And when you're talking about, the way cops talked in the 1930s, or the way the average person talked. You know, it does seem very important to ring, you know, to stay true to that, you know, and show the city warts and all, you know.
Well, and this is a reminder that we have made progress, that things are not the worst they've ever been, although we came close to throwing away our form of self-government with Trump.
And it's hard to see how we're going to go forward from that, but, you know, let me end up this by saying that John's wonderful book, City of Dark Corners, has had not one but two starred reviews in the review media, which is remarkable. And I love the way that two of the men, so the one from Library Journal, which is an important review media, especially, as you might guess, for libraries, says this gritty standalone deals with Phoenix's rough and tumble past and its questionable police force in the 1930s. Talton excels at creating the ambience of historical Phoenix, suggested for fans of historical mysteries or Phoenix noir. But the Publishers Weekly one, I really like the way it adds references to movie actors and other celebrities of the day, as well as speakeasies and bootleggers, lend atmosphere to this well-crafted tale involving desperate people who could easily disappear. Hopefully Hammond's, a man of too much integrity for his own good, will be back soon. And I hope so too. So my final question is, you know, are you writing another book about Gene Hammond?
I don't know yet. I have a new publisher.
Very true. I hope that you will be writing another book about Gene Hammond. And for those who are waiting after you read this book and want more, The Bomb Shelter, which is the most recent of the David Mapstone books, some of the characters and some of the things that go on, some of the characters that you read about in City of Dark Corners, you can read about as they're older in The Bomb Shelter. And you focus that one around the murder of Don Bowles, but in order to do that, you do dive back into a lot of Phoenix history. So we're still there with the Goldwaters and the Rosenzweigs.
There's a lot of connective tissue between those two eras.
There really are. And a brief history of Phoenix. I mean, it's almost like a trilogy if you think about it, you know, different aspects of it. But I do think this is a wonderful book, and I really recommend it to all fans of John. And if you've never read one of John's books, it's an excellent book to start with, because it is the first, or it's either a standalone or the first in series, depending on how you look at it. But I think you did a marvelous job with it.
Thank you.
Do you find that the distance of writing from Seattle makes any difference?
Well, I still have a place in Phoenix, in Midtown, on the light rail line, but I've been kind of stuck up here because of the pandemic. I did some of my best writing about Phoenix at a distance. I mean, I wrote I wrote Concrete Desert and Cactus Heart in Cincinnati, and then I wrote Camelback Falls in Charlotte, and then I wrote everything from The Night Detectives onto the Bomb Shelter, mostly in Seattle. So Phoenix is my muse. No matter where I am, they kick me out, but they can't quite get rid of me.
That distance can sharpen your focus in lots of respects. I mean, you wrote the two Cincinnati books in Phoenix, you know, so. You did. So
One of them was written in Seattle.
Oh, was it? The second one? Had you already been by then?
Yeah.
You haven't written in Seattle.
I just wanted to acknowledge that you moved.
Deadline Man is Seattle.
Yeah, no, that one for sure. But in any case, you've done a wonderful body of work, Jen, and I think this is a terrific addition to it. So, it's really been a pleasure to talk to you. We definitely recommend that you order copies of it. And because if you do, it will help encourage John and his publisher to write a sequel, which I think would be outstanding.
Absolutely.
Anyway, thank you, Deadline Woman.
You're welcome. Lovely to see you again.
Thank you, Patrick.
Great to see you as always.
It's really been a pleasure. So good night, everybody. Thank you for spending some time with us this evening.
Good night. Thank you.
Say hi to Susan.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.